She rose, felt age and rheumatism in her bones, and walked slowly to the Terminex. She paused a moment by the gently humming portal, looking over her shoulder for a final glimpse of Maui Covenant. The breeze carried in from the sea, but it carried the flat stench of oil spills and refinery gases, and Gladstone turned her face away. The weight of Lussis fell on her caped shoulders like iron shackles. It was rush hour in the concourse, and thousands of commuters, shoppers, and tourists crowded every walkway level, filled the kilometer-long escalators with colorful humanity, and gave the air a rebreathed heaviness that mixed with the sealed system scent of oil and ozone. Gladstone ignored the expensive shopping levels and took a Purstrans discway the 10 clicks to the main Shrike temple. There were police interdiction and containment fields glowing violet and green beyond the base of the wide stairway. The temple itself was boarded and dark. Many of the tall, thin, stained-glass windows facing the concourse had been shattered. Gladstone remembered the reports of riots months before and knew that the bishop and his acolytes had fled. She walked close to the interdiction field, staring through the shifting violet haze at the stairway where Braun Lamia had carried her dying client and lover, the original Keat Sybrid, to the waiting Shrike priests. Gladstone had known Braun's father well. They had spent their early Senate years together. Senator Byron Lamia had been a brilliant man. At one time, long before Braun's mother had come on the social scene from her backwater province of Freeholm, Gladstone had considered marrying him. And when he died, part of Gladstone's youth had been buried with him. Byron Lamia had been obsessed with the Techno Corps, consumed with the mission of moving humankind out from under the bondage the AIs had imposed over 5 centuries and 1,000 light-years. It had been Braun Lamia's father who had made Gladstone aware of the danger, had led her to the commitment which would result in the most terrible betrayal in the history of man. And it was Senator Byron Lamia's suicide that had trained her to decades of caution. Gladstone did not know if it had been agents of the Corps that had orchestrated the senator's death. Perhaps it had been elements of the hegemony hierarchy protecting its own vested interests. But she did know that Byron Lamia would never have taken his own life, never have abandoned his helpless wife and headstrong daughter in such a way. Senator Lamia's last Senate act had been to co-propose protectorate status for Hyperion, a move that would have brought the world into the web 20 standard years earlier than the events now unfolding. After his death, the surviving co-sponsor, the newly influential Mayna Gladstone, had withdrawn the bill. Gladstone found a drop shaft and fell past shopping levels and residential levels, manufacturing and service levels, waste disposal and reactor levels. Both her comm log and the drop shaft speaker began warning her that she was entering unlicensed and unsafe areas far beneath the hive. The drop shaft program tried to stop her descent. She overrode the command and silenced the warnings. She continued to drop, past levels without panels or lights now, descending through a tangle of fiber-optic spaghetti, heating and cooling ducts, and naked rock. Eventually, she stopped. Gladstone emerged into a corridor, lighted only by distant glow globes and oily firefly paint. Water dripped from 1,000 cracks in ceilings and walls and accumulated in toxic puddles. Steam drifted from apertures in the wall that might be other corridors or personal cubbies or merely holes. Somewhere in the distance, there was the ultrasonic scream of metal cutting metal. Closer, the electronic screeches of Nile music. Somewhere a man screamed and a woman laughed, her voice echoing metallically down shafts and conduits. There came the sound of a flechette rifle coughing. Dreg's Hive. Gladstone came to an intersection of cave corridors and paused to look around. Her micro-remote dipped and circled closer now, as insistent as an angered insect. It was calling for security backup. Only Gladstone's persistent override prevented its cry being heard. Dreg's Hive. This was where Braunlania and her cybrid lover had hidden for those last few hours before their attempt to reach the Shrike Temple. This was one of the myriad underbellies of the web, where the black market could provide anything from flashback to force-grade weapons, illegal androids to bootleg Poulsen treatments that would as likely kill you as give you another 20 years of youth. Gladstone turned right down the darkest corridor. Something the size of a rat, but with many legs, scurried into a broken ventilator tube. Gladstone smelled sewage, sweat, the ozone of overworked datum plane decks, the sweet scent of handgun propellant, vomit, and the reek of low-grade pheromones mutated to toxins. She walked the corridors, thinking of the weeks and months to come, the terrible price the worlds would pay for her decisions, her obsessions. 5 youths, tailored by backroom arnists to the point they were more animal than human, stepped into the corridor in front of Gladstone. She paused. The micro-remote dropped in front of her and neutralized its camouflage polymers. The creatures in front of her laughed, seeing only a machine the size of a wasp bobbing and darting in the air. It was quite possible that they were too far gone in the RNA tailoring even to recognize the device. 2 of them flicked open vibrates. 1 extended 10-centimeter-long steel claws. 1 clicked open a flechette pistol with rotating barrels. Gladstone did not want to fight. She knew, even if these dregs hive deadheads did not, that the micro could defend her from these 5 and 100 more. But she did not want someone killed simply because she chose the dregs as a place to take her walk. "Go away," she said. The youth stared, yellow eyes, bulbous black eyes, hooded slits and photoreceptive belly bands. In unison but spreading into a half circle, they took 2 steps toward her. Mayna Gladstone pulled herself erect, gathered her cape around her, and dropped the privacy collar enough that they could see her eyes. "Go away," she said again. The youths paused. Feathers and scales vibrated to unseen breezes. On 2 of them, antennae quivered and thousands of small sensory hairs pulsed. They went away. Their departure was as silent and swift as their arrival. In a second, there was no sound but water dripping, distant laughter. Gladstone shook her head, summoned her personal portal, and stepped through. Saul Weintraub and his daughter had come from Barnard's world. Gladstone translated to a minor Terminex in their hometown of Crawford. It was evening. Low, white homes, set back on manicured lawns, reflected Canadian Republic revival sensibilities and farmers' practicality. The trees were tall, broad-limbed, and amazingly faithful to their old earth heritage. Gladstone turned away from the flow of pedestrians, most hurrying home after a workday elsewhere in the web, and found herself strolling down brick walkways past brick buildings set around a grassy oval. To her left, she caught glimpses of farm fields past a row of homes. Tall green plants, possibly corn, grew in softly sighing ranks that stretched to the distant horizon where the last arc of a huge red sun was setting. Gladstone walked through the campus, wondering if this had been the college where Saul had taught, but not curious enough to query the datasphere. Gas lamps were lighting themselves under the canopy of leaves, and the first stars were becoming visible in the gaps where sky faded from azure to amber to ebony. Gladstone had read Weintraub's book, The Abraham Dilemma, in which he analyzed the relationship between a god who demanded the sacrifice of a son and the human race who agreed to it. Weintraub had reasoned that the Old Testament Jehovah had not simply been testing Abraham, but had communicated in the only language of loyalty, obedience, sacrifice, and command that humankind could understand at that point in the relationship. Weintraub had dealt with the New Testament's message as a presage of a new stage in that relationship, a stage wherein mankind would no longer sacrifice its children to any god for any reason, but where parents, entire races of parents, would offer themselves up instead. Thus the 20th century Holocausts, the brief exchange, the tripartite wars, the reckless centuries, and perhaps even the big mistake of 38. Finally, Weintraub had dealt with refusing all sacrifice, refusing any relationship with God except one of mutual respect and honest attempts at mutual understanding. He wrote about the multiple deaths of God and the need for a divine resurrection now that humankind had constructed its own gods and released them on the universe. Gladstone crossed a graceful stone bridge arcing over a stream lost in shadows, its whereabouts indicated only by the noises it made in the dark. Soft yellow light fell on railings of hand-set stone. Somewhere off campus, a dog barked and was hushed. Lights burned on the third floor of an old building, a gabled and roughly shingled brick structure that must date back to before the Hegira. Gladstone thought about Saul Weintraub and his wife Sarai and their beautiful 26-year-old daughter, returning from a year of archaeological discovery on Hyperion, with no discovery except the Shrike's curse, the Merlin's sickness. Saul and Sarai watching as the woman aged backward to child, from child to infant. And then Saul watching alone, after Sarai died in a senseless, stupid EMV crash while visiting her sister. Rachel Weintraub, whose first and final birthday would arrive in less than 3 standard days. Gladstone pounded her fist against stone, summoned her portal, and went elsewhere. It was midday on Mars. The Tharsis slums had been slums for 6 centuries and more. The sky overhead was pink, the air too thin and too cold for Gladstone, even with her cape around her, and dust blew everywhere. She walked the narrow lanes and cliff walks of Relocation City, never finding an open enough spot to see anything beyond the next cluster of hovels or dripping filter towers. There were few plants here. The great forests of the greening had been cut down for firewood, or died, and been covered by red dunes. Only a few bootleg brandy cacti and scuttling packs of parasitic spider lichen were visible between paths packed hard as stone by 20 generations of bare feet. Gladstone found a low rock and rested, lowering her head and massaging her knees. Groups of children, each naked except for strips of rags and dangling shunt jacks, surrounded her, begged for money, and then ran away giggling when she did not respond. The sun was high. Mons Olympus and the stark beauty of Fedmon Kassad's Force Academy were not visible from here. Gladstone looked around. This was where the proud man had come from. Here is where he had run with youth gangs before being sentenced to the order, sanity, and honor of the military. Gladstone found a private place and stepped through her portal. God's Grove was as it always was, perfumed by the scent of 1,000,000 trees, silent, except for the soft sounds of leaf rustle and wind, colored in half-tones and pastels. The sunset igniting the literal rooftop of the world as an ocean of treetops caught the light, each leaf shimmering to the breeze, glittering with dew and morning showers. As the breeze rose and carried the smell of rain and wet vegetation to Gladstone, on her platform high above the world, still sunk in sleep and darkness, 0.5 kilometer below. A Templar approached. Saw the glint of Gladstone's access bracelet as she moved her hand and withdrew, a tall, robed figure, blending back into the maze of foliage and vines. The Templars were one of the trickiest variables in Gladstone's game. Their sacrifice of their tree ship Yggdrasil was unique, unprecedented, inexplicable, and worrisome. Of all her potential allies in the war to come, none were more necessary and inscrutable than the Templars. Dedicated to life and devoted to the Muir, the Brotherhood of the Tree was a small but potent force in the web, a token of ecological awareness in a society devoted to self-destruction and waste, but unwilling to acknowledge its indulgent ways. Where was Hetmestine? Why had he left the Mobius Cube with the other pilgrims? Gladstone watched the sunrise, the sky filled with orphan Montgolfiers, saved from the slaughter on Whirl, their many-hued bodies floating skyward like so many Portuguese men-o'-war. Radiant gossamers spread membrane-thin solar wings to collect the sunlight. A flock of ravens broke cover and spiraled skyward, their cries providing harsh counterpoint to the soft breeze and sibilant rush of rain coming toward Gladstone from the west. The insistent sound of raindrops on leaves reminded her of her own home in the deltas of Potofa, of a 100-day monsoon, which sent her and her brothers out into the fens, hunting for toad flyers, bendits, and Spanish moss serpents to bring to school in a jar. Gladstone realized for the 100,000th time that there was still time to stop things. All-out war was not inevitable at this point. The ousters had not counterattacked yet in a way the hegemony could not ignore. The Shrike was not free. Not yet. All she had to do to save 100 billion lives was return to the Senate floor, reveal 3 decades of deception and duplicity, reveal her fears and uncertainties. No. It would go as planned until it went beyond planning. Into the unforeseen, into the wild waters of chaos, where even the Technocore predictors, those who saw everything, would be blind. Gladstone walked the platforms, towers, ramps, and swinging bridges of the Templar Tree City, arboreals from a score of worlds, and arnied chimps scolded her and fled, swinging gracefully from flimsy vines 300 meters above the forest floor. From areas closed to tourists and privileged visitors, Gladstone caught the scent of incense and clearly heard the Gregorian-like chants of the Templar sunrise service. Beneath her, the lower levels were coming alive with light and movement. The brief showers had passed over, and Gladstone returned to the upper levels, rejoicing in the view, crossing a 60-meter wooden suspension bridge connecting her tree to one even larger, where half a dozen of the great hot air balloons, the only air transport the Templars allowed on God's Grove, hung tethered and seemingly impatient to be away, their passenger nacelles swinging like heavy brown eggs, the skins of the balloons lovingly dyed in the patterns of living things, Montgolfiers, monarch butterflies, Thomas hawks, radiant gossamers, the now extinct zeppelins, sky squids, moon moths, eagles, so revered in legend that they had never been retrieved or arnied, and more. All this could be destroyed if I continue. Will be destroyed. Gladstone paused at the edge of a circular platform and gripped a railing so tightly that the age models on her hands stood out harshly against suddenly pale skin. She thought of the old books she had read, pre-Hegira, pre-spaceflight, where people and embryonic nations on the continent of Europe had transported darker people, Africans, away from their homelands into a life of slavery in the colonial West. Would those slaves, chained and shackled, naked and curled in the fetid belly of a slave ship, would those slaves have hesitated to rebel, to drag down their captors if it meant destroying the beauty of that slave ship, of Europe itself? But they had Africa to return to. Mayna Gladstone let out a sound part groan and part sob. She whirled away from the glorious sunrise, from the sound of chants greeting the new day, from the rise of balloons, living and artificial, into the newborn sky. And she went below, down into the relative darkness, to summon her Farcaster. She could not go where the last pilgrim, Martin Silenus, had come from. Silenus was only 150 old, half blue from Poulsen treatments, his cells remembering the cold freeze of 12 long cryogenic fugues and even colder storage. But his lifetime had spanned more than 4 centuries. He had been born on old Earth during the last days there. his mother from one of the noblest families, his youth a pastiche of decadence and elegance, beauty and the sweet smell of decay. While his mother stayed with the dying earth, he had been sent spaceward so that someone could clear family debts, even if it meant, which it did, years of service as a bonded manual laborer on one of the most hellish backwater worlds in the web. Gladstone could not go to Old Earth, so she went to Heaven's Gate. Mudflat was the capital, and Gladstone walked the cobblestone streets there, admiring the large old houses which overhung the narrow, stone-troughed canals crisscrossing their way up the artificial mountainside, like something from an Escher print. Elegant trees and even larger horsetail ferns crowned the hilltops, lined the broad white avenues, and swept out of sight around the elegant curve of white sand beaches. The lazy tide brought in violet waves, which prismed to a score of colors before dying on the perfect beaches. Gladstone paused at a park looking over the mud-flat promenade, where scores of couples and carefully dressed tourists took the evening air under gas lamp and leaf shadow, and she imagined what Heaven's Gate had been more than 3 centuries earlier, when it was a rough protectorate world, not yet fully terraformed, and young Martin Silenus still suffering from cultural dislocation, the loss of his fortune, and brain damage due to freezer shock on the long trip out, was working here as a slave. The atmospheric generating station then had provided a few hundred square kilometers of breathable air, marginally livable land. Tsunamis carried away cities, land reclamation projects, and workers with equal indifference. Bonded workers like Silenus dug out the acid canals, scraped rebreather bacteria from the lung pipe labyrinths under the mud, and dredged scum and dead bodies from the tidal mudflats after the floods. "We have made some progress," thought Gladstone, "despite the inertia forced upon us by the core, despite the near death of science, despite our fatal addiction to the toys granted us by our own creations." She was dissatisfied. Before this world walk was over, she had wanted to visit the home of each of the Hyperion pilgrims, however futile she knew that gesture to be. Heaven's Gate was where Silenus had learned to write true poetry, even while his temporarily damaged mind was lost to language. But this was not his home. Gladstone ignored the pleasant music rising from the concert on the promenade, ignored the flights of commuter EMVs moving overhead like migrating fowl, ignored the pleasant air and soft light as she called her portal to her and commanded it to farcast to Earth's moon. The moon. Instead of activating the translation, her comlog warned her of the dangers of going there. She overrode it. Her micro-remote buzzed into existence, its tiny voice in her implant suggesting that it was not a good idea for the chief executive to travel to such an unstable place. She silenced it. The Farcaster portal itself began to argue with her choice until she used her universal card to program it manually. The Farcaster door blurred into existence, and Gladstone stepped through. The only place on Old Earth's moon still habitable was the mountain and mare area preserved for the Force Masada ceremony, and it was here that Gladstone stepped out. The viewing stands and marching field were empty. Class 10 containment fields blurred the stars and the distant rim walls, but Gladstone could see where internal heating from terrible gravity tides had melted the distant mountains and made them flow into new seas of rock. She moved across a plain of gray sand, feeling the light gravity like an invitation to fly. She imagined herself as one of the Templar balloons, lightly tethered but eager to be away. She resisted the impulse to jump, to leap along in giant bounds, but her step was light, and dust flew in improbable patterns behind her. The air was very thin under the containment field dome, and Gladstone found herself shivering despite the heating elements in her cape. For a long moment, she stood in the center of the featureless plane and tried to imagine just the moon, humankind's first step in its long stagger from the cradle. But the force viewing stands and equipment sheds distracted her, made such imaginings futile, and finally she raised her eyes to see what she had actually come for. Old Earth hung in the black sky. But not old Earth, of course. Merely the pulsing accretion disk and globular cloud of debris which had once been old Earth. It was very bright. Brighter than any of the stars seen from Potapha on even the rarest clear night. But its brightness was strangely ominous, and it cast a sick light across the mud-gray field. Gladstone stood and stared. She had never been here before, had made herself not come before, and now that she was here, she desperately wanted to feel something, hear something. As if some voice of caution, or inspiration, or perhaps merely commiseration would come to her here. She heard nothing. She stood there, another few minutes, thinking of little, feeling her ears and nose beginning to freeze, before she decided to go. It would be almost dawn on TC Squared. Gladstone had activated the portal, and was taking a final look around when another portable farcaster door blurred into existence less than 10 meters away. She paused. Not 5 human beings in the web had individual access to Earth's moon. The micro-remote buzzed down to float between her and the figure emerging from the portal. Lee Hunt stepped out, glanced around, shivered from the cold, and walked quickly toward her. His voice was thin, almost amusingly childlike in the thin air.
M. Chief Executive, you must return at once. The ousters have succeeded in breaking through in an amazing counterattack.
Gladstone sighed. She had known that this would be the next step. All right, she said. Has Hyperion fallen? Can we evacuate our forces from there? Hunt shook his head. His lips were almost blue from the cold.
"You don't understand," came the attenuated voice of her aide. "It's not just Hyperion. The ousters are attacking at 12 points. They're invading the web itself."
Suddenly numb and chilled to her core, more from shock than from the lunar cold, Mayna Gladstone nodded, gathered her cape more tightly around her, and stepped back through the portal to a world which would never be the same again. 19. They gathered at the head of the Valley of the Time Tombs, Braun Lamia and Martin Silenus burdened with as many backpacks and carrying bags as they could manage, Saul Weintraub, the consul, and Father Duray standing silent as a tribunal of patriarchs. The first shadows of afternoon were beginning to stretch east across the valley, reaching for the softly glowing tombs like fingers of darkness.
"I'm still not sure it's a good idea to split up like this," said the consul, rubbing his chin.
It was very hot. Sweat gathered on his stubbled cheeks and ran down his neck. Lamia shrugged. "We knew that we each would be confronting the Shrike alone. Does it matter if we're separated a few hours? We need the food. You three could come if you want." The consul and Saul glanced at Father Duray. The priest was obviously exhausted. The search for Kassad had drained whatever reserves of energy the man had kept after his ordeal.
"Someone should wait here in case the colonel returns," said Saul.
The baby looked very small in his arms. Lamia nodded agreement. She settled straps on her shoulders and neck.
"All right. It should be about 2 hours getting to the keep. A little longer coming back. Figure a full hour there loading supplies. And we'll still be back before dark, close to dinner time."
The consul and Duray shook hands with Silenus. Saul put his arms around Braun.
"Come back safely," he whispered.
She touched the bearded man's cheek, set her hand on the infant's head for a second, turned and started up the valley at a brisk pace.
"Hey, wait a fucking minute for me to catch up,"
called Martin Silenus, canteens and water bottles clattering as he ran. They came up out of the saddle between the cliffs together.
Silenus glanced back and saw the other three men, already dwarfed by distance, small sticks of color amid the boulders and dunes near the Sphinx.
"It isn't going quite as planned, is it?"
he said. "I don't know," said Lamia. She had changed into shorts for the hike, and the muscles of her short, powerful legs gleamed under a sheen of sweat. "How was it planned?"
"My plan was to finish the universe's greatest poem and then go home," said Silenus.
He took a drink from the last bottle holding water.
"God damn, I wish we'd brought enough wine to last us."
"I didn't have a plan," said Lamia, half to herself. Her short curls, matted with perspiration, clung to her broad neck. Martin Silenus snorted a laugh.
"You wouldn't be here if it weren't for that cyborg lover."
"Client," she snapped.
"Whatever. It was the Johnny Keats retrieval persona who thought it was important to get here. So now you've dragged him this far. You're still carrying the Shrone loop, aren't you?"
Lamia absently touched the tiny neural shunt behind her left ear. A thin membrane of osmotic polymer kept sand and dust out of the follicle-sized connector sockets.
"Yes."
Silenus laughed again.
"What the fuck good is it if there's no datasphere to interact with, kid? You might as well have left the Keats persona on Lassus or wherever."
The poet paused a second to adjust straps and packs.
"Say, can you access the personality on your own?"
Lamia thought of her dreams the night before. The presence in them had felt like Johnny, but the images had been of the web.
"Memories?"
"No," she said. "I can't access a Shrone loop by myself. It carries more data than 100 simple implants could deal with. Now why don't you shut up and walk?" She picked up the pace and left him standing there. The sky was cloudless, verdant, and hinting of depths of lapis. The boulder field ahead stretched southwest to the barrens surrendering to the dune fields. The two walked in silence for 30 minutes, separated by 5 meters and their thoughts. Hyperion sun hung small and bright to their right. "The dunes are steeper," said Lamia, as they struggled up to another crest and slid down the other side. The surface was hot, and already her shoes were filling with sand. Silenus nodded, stopped, and mopped his face with a silken handkerchief. His floppy purple beret hung low over his brow and left ear, but offered no shade.
"It would be easier following the high ground to the north there, near the Dead City."
Braun Lamia shielded her eyes to stare in that direction. "We'll lose at least half an hour going that way."
"We'll lose more than that going this way."
Silenus sat on the dune and sipped from his water bottle. He pulled off his cape, folded it, and stuffed it in the largest of his backpacks.
"What are you carrying there?" asked Lamia. "That pack looks full." "None of your damned business, woman."
Lamia shook her head, rubbed her cheeks, and felt the sunburn there. She was not used to so many days in sunlight, and Hyperion's atmosphere blocked little of the ultraviolet. She fumbled in her pocket for the tube of sunblock cream and smeared some on.
"All right," she said. "We'll detour that way. Follow the ridge line until the worst of the dunes are passed, and then cut back on a straight line toward the keep."
The mountains hung on the horizon, seeming to grow no closer. The snow-topped summits tantalized her with their promise of cool breezes and fresh water. The Valley of the Time Tombs was invisible behind them, the view blocked by dunes and the boulder field. Lamia shifted her packs, turned to her right, and half-slid, half-walked down the crumbling dune. As they came up out of the sand, onto the low gorse and needle grass of the ridge, Martin Silenus could not take his eyes from the ruins of the City of Poets. Lamia had cut left around it, avoiding everything but the stones of the half-buried highways that circled the city, other roads leading out into the barrens until they disappeared beneath the dunes. Silenus fell farther and farther behind until he stopped and sat on a fallen column, which had once been a portal through which the android laborers filed every evening after working in the fields. Those fields were gone now, the aqueducts, canals, and highways only hinted at by fallen stones, depressions in the sand, or the sand-scoured stumps of trees where once they had overhung a waterway or shaded a pleasant lane. Martin Silenus used his beret to mop his face as he stared at the ruins. The city was still white. as white as bones uncovered by shifting sands, as white as teeth in an earth-brown skull. From where he sat, Silenus could see that many of the buildings were as he had last seen them more than a century and a half ago. Poet's amphitheater lay half-finished but regal in its ruin, a white, otherworldly Roman Colosseum overgrown with desert creeper and fanfare ivy. The great atrium was open to the sky, the gallerias shattered. Not by time, Silenus knew, but by the probes and lances and explosive charges of sad King Billy's useless security people in the decades after the evacuation of the city. They were going to kill the Shrike. They were going to use electronics and angry beams of coherent light to kill Grendel after he had laid waste to the Mead Hall. Martin Silenus chuckled and leaned forward, suddenly dizzy from the heat and exhaustion. Silenus could see the great dome of the common hall where he had eaten his meals, first with the hundreds in artistic camaraderie, then in separation and silence with the few others who had remained, for their own inscrutable and unrecorded reasons, after Billy's evacuation to Keats, and then alone, truly alone. Once he had dropped a goblet, and the echo rang for half a minute under the vine-graffitied dome. Alone with the Morlocks, thought Silenus. But not even Morlocks for company in the end. Only my muse. There was a sudden explosion of sound, and a score of white doves burst from some niche in the heap of broken towers that had been sad King Billy's palace. Silenus watched them whirl and circle in the overheated sky, marveling that they had survived the centuries here on the edge of nowhere. If I could do it, why not they? There were shadows in the city, pools of sweet shade. Silenus wondered if the wells were still good, the great underground reservoirs, sunk before the human seed ships had arrived, still filled with sweet water. He wondered if his wooden work table, an antique from old earth, still sat in the small room in which he had written much of his cantos. What's wrong? Braun Lamia had retraced her steps and was standing near him. Nothing. He squinted up at her. The woman looked like some squat tree, a mass of dark thigh roots and sunburned bark and frozen energy. He tried to imagine her being exhausted. The effort made him tired. I just realized, he said. We're wasting our time going all the way back to the keep. There are wells in the city, probably food reserves too. Uh-uh, said Lamia. The consul and I thought of that, talked about it. The dead city's been looted for generations. Shrike pilgrims must have depleted the stores 60 or 80 years ago. The wells aren't dependable. The aquifer has shifted. The reservoirs are contaminated. We go to the keep. Silenus felt his anger grow at the woman's insufferable arrogance, her instant assumption that she could take command in any situation. I'm going to explore, he said. It might save us hours of travel time. Lamia moved between him and the sun. Her black curls glowed with the corona of eclipse. No, if we waste time here, we won't be back before dark. Go on, then, snapped the poet, surprised at what he was saying. I'm tired. I'm going to check out the warehouse behind the common hall. I might remember storage places the pilgrims never found. He could see the woman's body tense as she considered dragging him to his feet, pulling him out onto the dunes again. They were little more than a third of the way to the foothills, where the long climb to the keep staircase began. Her muscles relaxed. Martin, she said, the others are depending on us. Please don't screw this up. He laughed and sat back against the tumbled pillar. Fuck that, he said. I'm tired. You know that you're going to do 95% of the transporting anyway. I'm old, woman. Older than you can imagine. Let me stay and rest a while. Maybe I'll find some food. Maybe I'll get some writing done. Lamia crouched next to him and touched his pack. That's what you've been carrying. The pages of your poem, the cantos. Of course, he said. And you still think that proximity to the Shrike will allow you to finish it? Silenus shrugged, feeling the heat and dizziness whirl around him. The thing is a fucking killer. A sheet metal Grendel forged in hell, he said. But it's my muse. Lamia sighed, squinted at the sun already lowering itself toward the mountains, and then looked back the way they had come. "Go back," she said softly. "To the valley." She hesitated a moment. "I'll go with you, then return." Silenus smiled with cracked lips.
"Why go back? To play cribbage with three other old men until our beastie comes to tuck us in? No thanks. I'd rather rest here a bit and get some work done." "Go on, woman. You can carry more than three poets could."
He struggled out of his empty packs and bottles, handing them to her. Lamia held the tangle of straps in a fist as short and hard as the head of a steel hammer. "Are you sure? We can walk slowly." He struggled to his feet, fueled by a moment of pure anger at her pity and condescension.
"Fuck you and the horse you rode in on, Lucian. In case you forgot, the purpose of the pilgrimage was to get here and say hello to the Shrike. Your friend Hoyt didn't forget. Cassad understood the game. The fucking Shrike's probably chewing on his stupid military bones right now. I wouldn't be surprised if the three we left behind don't need food or water by this point. Go on, get the hell out of here. I'm tired of your company."
Braun Lamia remained crouching for a moment, looking up at him as he weaved above her. Then she got to her feet, touched his shoulder for the briefest of seconds, lifted the packs and bottles to her back, and swung away, her pace faster than anything he could have kept up with in his youth.
"I'll be back this way in a few hours," she called, not turning back to look at him. "Be out on this edge of the city. We'll return to the tombs together."
Martin Silenus said nothing as he watched her diminish and then disappear in the rough ground to the southwest. The mountains shimmered in the heat. He looked down and saw that she had left the water bottle for him. He spat, added the bottle to his load, and walked into the waiting shade of the dead city.
20. Duray all but collapsed while they were eating lunch from the last two ration packs. Saul and the consul carried him up the Sphinx's wide stairway into the shade. The priest's face was as white as his hair. He attempted a smile as Saul lifted a water bottle to his lips.
"All of you accept the fact of my resurrection rather easily,"
he said, wiping the corners of his mouth with a finger. The consul leaned back against the stone of the Sphinx.
"I saw the cruciforms on Hoyt, the same as you wear now.
And I believed his story, your story," said Saul.
He passed the water to the consul. Duray touched his forehead.
"I've been listening to the comlog discs. The stories, including mine, are incredible."
"Do you doubt any of them?"
asked the consul.
"No, it is making sense of them that is the challenge. Finding the common element, the string of connection."
Saul lifted Rachel to his chest, rocking her slightly, his hand on the back of her head.
"Does there have to be a connection, other than the Shrike?"
"Oh, yes," said Duray.
A bit of color was returning to his cheeks.
"This pilgrimage was not an accident, nor was your selection."
"Different elements had a say in who came on this pilgrimage," said the consul. "The AI advisory group, the Hegemony Senate, even the Shrike Church."
Duray shook his head.
"Yes, but there was only one guiding intelligence behind this selection, my friends."
Saul leaned closer.
"God?"
"Perhaps," said Duray, smiling. "But I was thinking of the Corps, the artificial intelligences, who have behaved so mysteriously through this entire sequence of events."
The baby made soft, mewling noises. Saul found a pacifier for it and tuned the comlog on his wrist to heartbeat rates. The child curled its fists once and relaxed against the scholar's shoulder.
"Braun's story suggests that elements in the Corps are trying to destabilize the status quo, allow humankind a chance for survival while still pursuing their ultimate intelligence project."
The consul gestured toward the cloudless sky.
"Everything that's happened, our pilgrimage, even this war, was manufactured because of the internal politics of the Corps."
"And what do we know of the Corps?"
asked Duray softly.
"Nothing,"
said the consul, and threw a pebble toward the carved stone to the left of the Sphinx's stairway. When all is said and done, we know nothing. DeRay was sitting up now, massaging his face with a slightly moistened cloth.
Yet their goal is oddly similar to our own.
What's that? Asked Saul, still rocking the baby.
To know God, said the priest. Or failing that, to create him.
He squinted down the long valley. Shadows were moving farther out from the southwestern walls now, beginning to touch and enfold the tombs.
I helped promote such an idea within the church.
I've read your treatises on St. Teilhard, said Saul. You did a brilliant job defending the necessity of evolution toward the Omega Point, the Godhead, without stumbling into the Socinian heresy.
The what? Asked the consul. Father DeRay smiled slightly.
Socinus was an Italian heretic in the 16th century A.D. His belief, for which he was excommunicated, was that God is a limited being, able to learn and to grow as the world, the universe, becomes more complex. And I did stumble into the Socinian heresy, Saul. That was the first of my sins.
Saul's gaze was level.
And the last of your sins?
Besides pride,
said DeRay.
The greatest of my sins was falsifying data from a 7-year dig on Armagast, trying to provide a connection between the vanished archbuilders there and a form of proto-Christianity. It did not exist. I fudged data. So the irony is, the greatest of my sins, at least in the church's eyes, was to violate the scientific method. In her final days, the church can accept theological heresy, but can brook no tampering with the protocols of science.
Was Armagast like this? Asked Saul, making a gesture with his arm that included the valley, the tombs, and the encroaching desert. DeRay looked around, his eyes bright for a moment.
The dust and stone and sense of death, yes, but this place is infinitely more threatening. Something here has not yet succumbed to death when it should have.
The consul laughed.
Let's hope that we're in that category.
I'm going to drag the comm log up to that saddle and try again to establish a relay link with the ship.
I'll go too, said Saul.
And I,
said Father DeRay. Getting to his feet, weaving for only a second, and refusing the offer of Weintraub's hand. The ship did not respond to queries. Without the ship, there could be no Fatline relay to the Ousters, the Web, or anywhere else beyond Hyperion. Normal comm bands were down.
Could the ship have been destroyed? Saul asked the consul.
No. The message is being received, just not responded to.
Gladstone still has the ship in quarantine.
Saul squinted out over the barrens to where the mountains shimmered in the heat haze. Several clicks closer, the ruins of the City of Poets rose jaggedly against the skyline.
Just as well, he said. We have one deus ex machina too many as it is.
Paul DeRay began to laugh then, a deep, sincere sound, and stopped only when he began coughing and had to take a drink of water.
What is it? Asked the consul. The deus ex machina. What we were talking about earlier. I suspect that this is precisely the reason each of us is here. Poor Lennar with his deus in the machina of the cruciform. Braun with her resurrected poet trapped in a shrone loop, seeking the machina to release her personal deus. You, Saul, waiting for the dark deus to solve your daughter's terrible problem. The core. Machina spawned, seeking to build their own deus.
The consul adjusted his sunglasses.
And you, father?
DeRay shook his head.
I wait for the largest machina of all to produce its deus. The universe. How much of my elevation of St. Teilhard stemmed from the simple fact that I found no sign of a living creator in the world today? Like the technocore intelligences, I seek to build what I cannot find elsewhere.
Saul watched the sky.
What deus do the Ousters seek?
The consul answered.
Their obsession with Hyperion is real. They think that this will be the birthplace of a new hope for humankind.
We'd better go back down,
said Saul, shielding Rachel from the sun.
Braun and Martin should be returning before dinner.
But they did not return before dinner. nor was there any sign of them by sunset. Every hour the consul walked to the valley entrance, climbed a boulder, and watched for movement out among the dunes and boulder field. There was none. The consul wished that Kassad had left a pair of his powered binoculars. Even before the sky faded to twilight, the bursts of light across its zenith announced the continuing battle in space. The three men sat on the highest step of the Sphinx's staircase and watched the light show. Slow explosions of pure white, dull red blossoms, and sudden green and orange streaks, which left retinal echoes.
"Who's winning, do you think?"
said Saul. The consul did not look up.
"It doesn't matter. Do you think we should sleep somewhere other than the Sphinx tonight? Wait at one of the other tombs?" "I can't leave the Sphinx," said Saul. "You're welcome to go on."
Duray touched the baby's cheek. She was working on the pacifier, and her cheek moved against his finger.
"How old is she now, Saul?"
2 days. Almost exactly. She would have been born about 15 minutes after sunset at this latitude, Hyperion time.
"I'll go up and look one last time," said the consul.
"Then we'll have to build a bonfire or something to help them find their way back." The consul had descended half the steps toward the trail when Saul stood and pointed. Not toward where the head of the valley glowed in low sunlight, but the other way, into the shadows of the valley itself. The consul stopped, and the other two men joined him. The consul reached into his pocket and removed the small neural stunner Kassad had given him several days earlier. With Lamia and Kassad gone, it was the only weapon they had.
"Can you see?" whispered Saul.
The figure was moving in the darkness beyond the faint glow of the jade tomb. It did not look large enough or move quickly enough to be the shrike. Its progress was strange. Slow, halting for half a moment at a time, weaving. Father Duray glanced over his shoulder at the entrance to the valley, then back.
"Is there any way Martin Silenus could have entered the valley from that direction?"
"Not unless he jumped down the cliff walls," whispered the consul, "or went 8 clicks around to the northeast. Besides, it's too tall to be Silenus."
The figure paused again, weaved, and then fell. From more than 100 meters away, it looked like another low boulder on the valley floor.
"Come," said the consul.
They did not run. The consul led the way down the staircase, stunner extended, set for 20 meters, although he knew the neural effect would be minimal at that range. Father Duray walked close behind, holding Saul's child while the scholar hunted for a small rock to carry.
"David and Goliath?"
asked Duray when Saul came up with palm-sized stone and set it in a fiber-plastic sling he had cut from package wrap that afternoon. The scholar's sunburned face above the beard turned a darker color.
"Something like that. Here, I'll take Rachel back. I enjoy carrying her. And if there's any fighting to be done, better the two of you have free hands."
Saul nodded and closed the gap to walk side by side with the consul, the priest and the child a few paces behind. From 15 meters away, it became obvious that the fallen figure was a man, a very tall man, wearing a rough robe and lying face down in the sand.
"Stay here,"
said the consul, and ran. The others watched while he turned over the body, set his stunner back in his pocket, and removed a water bottle from his belt. Saul jogged slowly, feeling his exhaustion as a kind of pleasant vertigo. Duray followed more slowly. When the priest came into the light thrown by the consul's hand torch, he saw the hood of the fallen man pushed back from a vaguely Asian, oddly distorted long face, lighted by the glow of the jade tomb as well as the torch.
"It's a Templar," said Duray, astonished to find a follower of the Muir here.
"It's the true voice of the tree," said the consul. "It's the first of our missing pilgrims. It's Het Mestin."
Martin Silenus had worked all afternoon on his epic poem, and only the dying of the light made him pause in his efforts. He had found his old workroom pillaged, the antique table missing. Sad King Billy's palace had suffered the worst of Time's insults, with all windows broken. Miniature dunes drifted across discolored carpets once worth fortunes, and rats and small rock eels living between the tumbled stones. The apartment towers were homes for the doves and hunting falcons gone back to the wild. Finally, the poet had returned to the common hall under the great geodesic dome of its dining room to sit at a low table and write. Dust and debris covered the ceramic floor, and the scarlet tones of desert creeper all but obscured the broken panes above. But Silenus ignored these irrelevancies and worked on his cantos. The poem dealt with the death and displacement of the Titans by their offspring, the Hellenic gods. It dealt with the Olympian struggle which followed the Titans' refusal to be displaced, the boiling of great seas as Oceanus struggled with Neptune, his usurper, the extinction of suns as Hyperion struggled with Apollo for control of the light, and the trembling of the universe itself as Saturn struggled with Jupiter for control of the throne of the gods. What was at stake was not the mere passage of one set of deities to be replaced by another, but the end of a golden age and the beginning of dark times which must spell doom for all mortal things. The Hyperion Kantos made no secret of the multiple identities of these gods. The Titans were easily understood to be the heroes of humankind's short history in the galaxy. The Olympian usurpers were the Technocore AIs, and their battlefield stretched across the familiar continents, oceans, and airways of all the worlds in the web. Amidst all this, the monster Dis, son of Saturn, but eager to inherit the kingdom with Jupiter, stalked its prey, harvesting both god and mortal. The cantos were also about the relationship between creatures and their creators, the love between parent and children, artists and their art, all creators and their creations. The poem celebrated love and loyalty, but teetered on the brink of nihilism, with its constant thread of corruption through love of power, human ambition, and intellectual hubris. Martin Silenus had been working on his cantos for more than 2 standard centuries. His finest work had been done in these surroundings, the abandoned city, the desert winds whining like an ominous Greek chorus in the background, the ever-present threat of the shrike's sudden interruption. By saving his own life, by leaving, Silenus had abandoned his muse and condemned his pen to silence. Beginning work again, following that sure trail, that perfect circuit which only the inspired writer has experienced, Martin Silenus felt himself returning to life, veins opening wider, lungs filling more deeply, tasting the rich light and pure air without being aware of them, enjoying each stroke of antique pen across the parchment, the great heap of previous pages stacked around on the circular table, chunks of broken masonry serving as paperweights, the story flowing freely again, immortality beckoning with each stanza, each line. Silenus had come to the most difficult and exciting part of the poem. The scenes where conflict has raged across 1,000 landscapes, entire civilizations have been laid waste, and representatives of the Titans call pause to meet and negotiate with the Olympians' humorless heroes. On this broad landscape of his imagination strode Saturn, Hyperion, Cotys, Iapetus, Oceanus, Briareus, Mimas, Porphyrion, Enceladus, Rhoetus, and others. Their equally titanic sisters, Tethys, Phoebe, Thea, and Clymene, and opposite them the doleful countenances of Jupiter, Apollo, and their ilk. Silenus did not know the outcome of this most epic of poems. He lived on now only to finish the tale, had done so for decades. Gone were the dreams of his youth of fame and wealth from apprenticing himself to the word. He had gained fame and wealth beyond measure, and it had all but killed him, had killed his art. And although he knew that the cantos were the finest literary work of his age, he wanted only to finish it, to know the outcome himself, and to set each stanza, each line, each word, in the finest, clearest, most beautiful form possible. Now he wrote feverishly, almost mad with desire to finish what he had long thought unfinishable. The words and phrases flew from his antique pen to the antiquated paper. Stanzas leaped into being with no effort. Cantos found their voice and finished themselves with no need for revision, no pause for inspiration. The poem unfolded with shocking speed, astounding